Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another great episode we have here of Suspense Radio. Today, we are going to have authors D.P. Lyle and Eric Davis on the show for you. I'm your host, John Robb, Suspense Radio, brought to you by Suspense Magazine. Let's not waste any time, because 60 minutes of Suspense Radio begins right now. Welcome, everybody, here on this great Saturday morning that we have here on Suspense Radio. Again, I'm your host, John Robb, and we are going to set it up right now and bring on our first guest, author of the latest book, which comes out here in April 1st to be exact, More Forensics in Fiction, was also, you know, the author of Stress Fracture, Hot Lights, Cold Steel, Royal Pains, the book Royal Pains. So I want to welcome author D.P. Lyle to the show. D.P., how you doing today?
Great, John. How you doing?
I'm doing fabulous, except like we talked a little off air, except the weather here in Southern California a little strange. Other than that, I woke up on the fleet. You know, I'm on the green side. Everything's good.
Absolutely.
Because I'll tell you, people might laugh and say, well, of course you're going to wake up on the green side. Or, there's a good chance of it. But when you read your book, More Forensics in Fiction, and you see some of the questions that go in there, you just really have no idea what is going through people's heads. Because in flipping through this book, and you break it out into five chapters. So it's got five parts, because you got everything in here from, you know, illness to doctors and hospitals to police procedural to odds and ends. Everything is in here, and every question is broken down.
That's true. It's organized like the other two books, so people will be familiar with it.
Right. I mean, and that's the thing, is that, you know, you were able to write another, because you wrote Forensics, you had Forensics in Fiction before, and then you had Forensics for Dummies, and I know it just keeps changing. What's kind of the big change that, you know, you put in here to More Forensics in Fiction that just keeps, you know, evolving, I guess you want to say, as medicine and everything else evolves?
Well, it's not so much that as it is that I just have so many wonderful questions, and as you pointed out, you know, there's a lot of odd and strange questions there and how writers' minds work. And, you know, we writers are very odd people, because how many people get up in the morning, have a cup of coffee, and start killing people?
Exactly.
And that's what writers do. And I've always jokingly said that in these books, I'm not responsible for the questions, only the answers. But the answers are actually the easy part. The hard part is asking the question, because what that implies is the person has sat down and really plotted out this story, has really spent countless hours putting this story together, and then they've come across something. Well, how does this work? I don't understand how to do this. I know what I want to happen, but what's it going to look like and smell like, and how's it going to work, and does it even make sense? So that's the kind of questions I get, and it really gives you an insight into the mind of crime writers, which are very twisted minds, I have to say. Which is a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. So, I mean, you're sitting there, you get a question, and you're like, okay, does it intrigue you to say, I got to see what the hell this book's about if they're asking this kind of question? Or you already sit there and say, yeah, you can kind of already give a sense of, you know, what they want to do and what they're going to do just by the questions that they ask on how they want to kill somebody?
Sure. A little bit of both. And a lot of the books, you know, that I always hope that the author lets me know when and if the book's published, because I like to go pick them up and read them and see how they use the information. You know, I may get asked the same question 20 times or something very similar 20 times and give, mm-hmm. you know, similar answers. But the product, the that the author comes up with after taking that information and folding it into this story will be 20 different stories, and it'll be used 20 different ways. And I'm always intrigued by that. I love storytelling, and I like the way the mind works, and I like the scenarios that people come up with. It makes me think, and I find it, as I always said, I had learned as much from the answers as I hope they do, you know, from researching them and writing them, because it makes me think, too.
Yeah, this is not only, I mean, what authors and what even, you know, fans, you know, fans that might not write still, you know, just to be able to be curious, to understand, like when you're watching CSI or when you're watching Law and Order, they don't always think that they have it correct, because that's Hollywood exaggeration at some point, and, you know, sometimes. But you are a consultant with Law and Order, CSI, Miami, and House in here, that you have consulted with the people to make sure that they do get the things right. So some of the things, you know, do you see, when you watch those shows, correlations to say, yeah, they should have asked me, or, you know, yeah, they did get it right?
Oh, I see that all the time. And what's interesting is last night there was a repeat of Nan was watching Monk, and she was watching a repeat, uh-huh. And I walked through, and she said, this is the one in Mexico. And that was what was interesting is that was a question that Lee Goldberg asked me, and we worked together on that script called Mr. Monk Goes to Mexico. And so, you know, you see those things that you talk to screenwriters about. You see those stories then appear on TV, and, you know, then you see how they use the information that we sat on the phone and discussed. And Lee, of course, is extremely, extremely creative.
Yeah, he is. I mean, and he writes a lot of the, Monk books and amongst a bunch of other stuff. And I saw his question in here, actually, too, about
his drawing.
He's
got several in there. He always does.
Yeah.
Well, that's one of the cool things about the book, I think, you were talking about for fans, and I agree. I think fans will really get a lot out of it because they will see how the writer's mind works. They will also see, because we attribute most of the questions to who it came from, they'll see some of their favorite writers in there and say, you know, from Harley Jane Kozak to Charlene Harris, to, you mentioned Lee Goldberg, Matt Whitten. I mean, there's a lot of people in there. Twist Phelan, I think, has a couple of questions in there. Simon Wood, and you see the questions come from the author, and so I hope people will then look at that and say, wow, I don't know about this author, but this is really a clever question, and then they'll go to their website and say, and buy a couple of their books. So I hope it is a marketing tool also.
Right, I mean, that is definitely one thing, just to get the idea to say, you know, and even if you're thinking about, you know, writing, and you're an author, and you're sitting down, and you're thinking about, okay, I got this great story, and I got this great idea, and, you know, then you start getting to the book, your book here, More Forensics and Fiction. And I want to remind everybody that we're speaking with author D.P. Lyle. DPLyleMD.com is the website to find that information, because there's a bunch of things that D.P. has written, like I mentioned at the outset, and they're all just fascinating. But if you want to write and you pick up the book and you see the different, you know, different authors and kind of how they work, you might start rethinking yourself, like, wow, maybe I should do a little bit more research or a little bit more ideas on exactly what I need to do and how I need to formulate that story together by using a tool. Because this is what it is. It's a fabulous tool for authors, and that's kind of why you did write it as a tool.
Sure. And I think also one of the aspects, and along what you were talking about, is it stimulates the writers to think, what if? Because they may be working on a story and they've been struggling with, but they start reading through this book and they come up with an idea that may push their story in a whole different direction. And they say, wow, I didn't realize that. And that's pretty cool. And, you know, that would actually work in my story. And, you know, of course, they're going to write it totally differently than the person that I wrote, you know, gave the answer to, because they're writing two different stories. But they will take that information and use it as the aha, what if moment. And then incorporate it into their story. So that's one of the things I think writers get out of it, is it makes them think a little differently. And to see what other people are doing, I think, always helps.
Well, let's just give a little example that people can understand about exactly, you know, when we talk about these questions and things that they're going to see in the book. Here's just one that, you know, I've always actually found interesting, and so I thought it was cool when I saw it in here, and I was like, wow, that's what really happens. And so here's a question actually from the book, More Forensics and Fiction, is this. What happens when someone swallows razor blades?
wasn't pretty.
That's the short answer. It ain't pretty.
Exactly. Needless to say, razor blades are some of the sharpest things that you have around the house. And, of course, we're talking about those old double-edged razors, you know, that that my dad used to use when I was a kid. They're still around. And you drop the blade into the thing and crank it closed, and that's what you use to shave with. But they can be single-edged or double-edged, but mostly double-edged. And they're thin, and they're extremely sharp. And, yes, I mean, this is not only a question. This has obviously happened. I mean, emergency room physicians have seen this for many, many years. Children sometimes get a hold of these razors. That's one of the reasons I'm glad they're mostly gone. And I've seen some horrendous things. But if you swallow them, it'll tear up your tongue and your mouth and your throat and your esophagus and your stomach. And it can literally slice the esophagus up and cause it to, which is the swallowing tube between the mouth and the stomach, and literally cause it to rip open and rupture. And then all the stomach contents go into the belly and the chest, and that is not pretty. And it bleeds like crazy, and you know, it can be it's not a minor injury, and it requires surgery to survive most of the time.
And so, and I guess that's the thing is just thinking, because everything that you said sounds like, yeah, you're dead. I mean, there's just no point. What is actually the percentage if someone did swallow a razor that they could actually survive that?
Well, it depends on, you know, obviously where they are. But if they get to an emergency room and they can pump them full of blood and get a surgeon in to open them up and fix everything, then the survival rate's very high, you know, unless they've been into shock and damaged their brain and kidneys and led to other complications. I mean, every injury that you can think of comes in 1,000 flavors, you know. It's this old saying in medicine, whatever happens, happens.
Right.
But people survive a lot of stuff. It's amazing, and they do survive this. But they got to get the help in a hurry, and the help's got to be fast and proficient. And then everything works fine. If it doesn't, then not so fine.
And, you know, just to let people know, because, you know, you've been doing this for quite some time, and like I said, you had Forensics for Dummies, you know, back in 2005. It actually won the McCavity Award for Best Nonfiction, nominated for an Edgar Award for Best Nonfiction also.
Correct.
And you had, you know, the Whodunit Forensics. So you've been doing this for a time. Just so people kind of know, why exactly did you decide, I'm going to put a book out? Was it just simply because, you know, or how were you the person that ended up getting all the questions?
Well, I have to blame Jan Burke for that. I always call her the – I like to blame Jan for everything that I can. But
that's good. I like
she
that,
won't
Dennis.
Let me. She hits me if I try to blame her for too much. But Jan was the past president of Mystery Writers of America, the Southern California chapter, and when she took over, she said, our newsletter's a little anemic, but write some articles. To make a long story short, I submitted an article called Timely Death, which dealt with how the coroner determines the time of death. And it was published in the newsletter, and there was a huge response. And Jan said, would you do some more, maybe answer some questions? I said, sure. So we started a thing called The Doctor Is In, and people would send me questions. And, of course, then you go to writers' conferences. You know how it is. People stop you in the car and say, I have this scenario. You know, and I love that stuff. And so from that, I started collecting questions, and I built a website basically to answer questions for people. And it's just blossomed. It's been going on 12 or 15 years now. I think I have a little over 6,000 questions on my computer that I've answered from writers over the years. So it's a lot of material there, and I enjoy it. But Jan's really the reason.
And so, and that way authors know, you will answer, any author that has a question about that, you will answer their question. I want to make sure, because you said that in the past many times, is that you're here to answer questions for authors, but you're not here to give medical advice to, like, just anybody.
Oh, no. If it has to do with a real-life situation, if someone's saying, you know, my brother-in-law was wrongly accused, and, you know, this is the evidence, sorry. For medical legal reasons, you do not get involved in real-life cases. It would be insane to do so because you only know a fraction of the story. And to draw any conclusions in a forensic field with part is insane. And, of course, giving medical advice to someone who you don't know, has never seen, never examined, don't know their history, et cetera, is equally insane. So that doesn't happen. So it has to be couched in the milieu of storytelling. I help people with fictional stories.
Yeah, I wanted, and the other disclaimer is, and it's actually in the front of the book, but just so you know, like with anything, the book here, More Forensics and Fiction, do not try these things at home. Okay,
no.
It's not for that. It's strictly for research purposes only.
Exactly. You don't want to try any of this stuff at all. Really?
So,
would that really work? Let's try it, Joe.
Yeah, let's do a Mythbusters, you know. I mean, those
exactly.
are people.
Or Jackass would probably be more appropriate, but yeah.
And that is so true. But we're speaking here with author D.P. Lyle, and the book is More Forensics and Fiction. And like I said, his website is dplylemd.com. And what you're going to find out is you're going to say, well, there's a bunch of stuff that D.P.'s written, and that's correct, because not only do you do nonfiction, but you have several fiction works. You have, you know, the one back stress fracture, which, you know, when people read, they have to understand, you know, your work is very much, you know, head on, bam, right in your face kind of thing. It's not you. When you view it, and I always like to use sports analogies, you're not a finesse pitcher. You're a strikeout pitcher. You're someone who comes right in head on. And that's the great thing when you went on from stress fracture to hot lights and cold steel. But then you also had to switch gears. You did some royal pain and you're doing those things. You know, so, and then now in August, your next book, Run to Ground, is coming out.
Exactly.
And so you're just busy running through, and these are all the Dub Walker thriller series that I just mentioned with Run to Ground, Hot Lights, Cold Steel, and Stress Fracture. But, you know, Hot Lights, Cold Steel was the latest one. And, you know, explain a little bit about, so people who think that maybe you're just nonfiction, that you actually do fiction. You know, let them know who Dub Walker is so
sure.
they can get another idea.
Well, Dub Walker is set in the South, and Dub Walker is a forensic evidence and criminal behavior expert. He's written a bunch of books on it and lectures on it, and actually ends up getting involved in solving cases. A lot of them become very personal. But that's his background. That's what he does. And so he and his best buddy, T. Tommy Tortelli, you know, everybody in the South has a funny name, but
of course.
T. Tommy is a homicide detective. And so the two of them often end up involved in solving very unusual, like Hot Lights, Cold Steel, it deals with robotic surgery. Stress Fracture dealt with post-traumatic stress disorder, if you want to know what the science was. But the stories are, like you said, they're down and dirty, and they're in your face, and they're not apologetic. But, you know, that's the people I read. You know, I read Bob Craze and Michael Connelly and Jeff Parker and of course, the great James Lee Burke and Elmore Leonard. And these are not guys that are known for pulling punches, and that's the kind of stuff I like to read. So it's the stuff I like to write.
Yeah, and that's the one thing when you get in, and you know, I know that my wife had wrote, you know, she read Stress Fracture, and then we kind of wrote back, and there are moments where you literally would gasp. It would just be like, oh my, wow, you know, oh my gosh. And I think that that's the reaction, you know, as an author that you like to hear from fans when they do write into you, other than saying, you know, like I said, you know, rainwater and tap water, can you tell, you know, which way somebody died if they drank either one?
Well, you're right. We live for gasp, and especially from intelligent, wide readers like you and Shannon are. I mean, I really appreciate that, and I'm flattered that you guys love it. Because you guys read a lot, and you are exposed to a lot. And so I take that as a compliment. But, yes, that's what we want. We're thriller writers. We want that thrill. We want people to send us an email and say, I hate you. I could not go to bed last night, you know.
Exactly.
That's probably the best compliment any thriller writer could get.
Yeah, that's the one thing that, you know, we, and like you said, we do get, you know, last year we got a little over 2,500 books sent to us. Now we can't get through all of them, but we do try. And when you see, you know, just the many different aspects of writing and everything else, it is good to know that there are still thriller writers, because a lot of them, I think, are becoming a little too finesse, that we get into thriller writing for authors like yourself because they are in-your-face, hard-nosed, don't pull the punches, because you do want the gas moment. You don't always want the finesse. You need a little something different.
Yeah, I think that's true, and that's why I read. That's why I read thrillers. You know, I want that thrill. I want something that I'm not going to want to, you know, put down at night.
And the other thing, that you do, because you do everything. I mean, when you go to a conference, like you're going to Left Coast Crime and Thriller Fest, you're going to see DP probably there, and he's probably going to be sitting at the bar with his laptop doing something. That's where we always meet you. The first place we always see you is at the bar, or at the restaurant with the laptop, and you're just sitting there working, and that's a good thing, because you are out in the masses, and a lot of people can come out and see you. And just exactly what is your schedule like this year for fans to be able to come out and meet you and talk with you?
Well, yeah, I keep it all on my website. But, I mean, like tonight I'm going up to the Yorba Linda Library. They're having a crime panel. So it'll be me and a county district attorney and a defense attorney and I think one other person. And we'll spend a couple of hours answering questions from the audience about, you know, forensics and crime stories and whatever. And I've done this two or three times in the past, and it's always wonderful. The Yorba Linda Library gets a great crowd. But then I'll be doing, I have a couple of book signings and book launches and stuff like that. But I'll be obviously going to Thriller Fest and Craft Fest. I have to, since I'm in charge of both this year.
Exactly.
But then I'm going to a Book Passage Conference the next week, actually, up in Corte Madera in the Bay Area. And the Book Passage, if people are not familiar with, is a wonderful bookstore up in Corte Madera, and they put on an incredible mystery writing conference that that Jackie Winspear and Sheldon Siegel actually spearhead. And there's always have wonderful instructors, and it's a very craft-oriented, small, friendly conference, very well done. And then after that, I'm going to the SEEK conference in Boston area, which actually down in Hyannis and teaching. And that's a thing that, you know, Michael Palmer and Tess Gerritsen were spearheaded, and it's teaching attorneys and physicians, you know, how to write crime fiction and how to write fiction. And so I haven't taught at that conference before, and I'm really looking forward to it. It's going to be fun.
You know, just sitting here listening, I would think probably about 15 years ago, there was none of these things around for authors, and you guys had to go ahead and kind of think of all this stuff on your own, because you had none of these conferences to go around. Now you have these best-selling authors basically telling professionals who want to write, you know, lawyers or doctors or anything else, how to do it. I mean, it's almost... you're almost making it too damn easy for them.
Well, an example is, remember, this is just the seventh year of Thriller Fest, which is International Thriller Writers, you know, annual meeting, and
right.
Craft Fest. This is, you know, our seventh year of Craft Fest. And if you look at where we started with nothing 7 years ago and where we are now, and if you want to know who's teaching at Craft Fest this year, my God, John Sanford, Joseph Wambaugh, Steve Barry, Jan Burke, Lee Child, Bob Degani, Catherine Coulter, Lisa Gardner, Andy Gross, Phil Margolin, Don Moss, Ann Rule is going to be there, for Christ's sakes. Of course, Michael Palmer. I mean, it goes on and on and on, and these are the people who are actually going to stand up in front of a class and teach the craft of thriller writing. Wow. You know, I'm a fan. I'm going to go sit in on all of these.
I mean, there's no excuse to write a crappy book if you go to these things, because they've given you, you're hearing from all the greatest minds, you know, ever. It's kind of being able to sit down, if you don't really know the stock market, and have, you know, Warren Buffett and all the greats sit there and basically say, this is what you do. Now go do it, because I've told you what to do, so now there's no excuse to lose money.
Exactly, and then you got to do what the great Bryce Courtney always said. He said, writing comes down to one thing, bum glue. Glue your bum to the chair and write.
And that's where it all comes to, is basically you get all the information, but you still got to use it.
It's a job, and you got to approach it as a job. You got to work hard at it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm going to tell you what, DP, it has been fascinating to have you on, just like always, and you know, you're going to be running all over Helangon here for the next at least 5 months. I know that. And we're going to be able to nail you down to come on next in August to be able to talk about your latest book that's coming out, then Run to Ground. But right now, everybody go get more forensics and fiction. Like I said, whether you're a writer, you have to have it if you're a writer, and you have to have it next to your computer so you can go and look everything up. And if you're a fan, you just got to read it, because the questions in there are going to absolutely just amaze you to think, not only did my favorite author write that, but now I see how she wrote it into the book, or he wrote it into the book. And guess who? And the answer came from not only but one DP Lyle. We want to thank him so much for coming on.
Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
All right. You have a good one, and enjoy your day.
You too.
All right. Again, everybody, DP Lyle MD is the website to go check out. If you're an author, you have questions, you are stumped or whatever, buy the book. If the question's not in the book and you have something that you really need to ask, you can always ask DP and email him. But I'm telling you, you got to pick up the book, Forensics for Dummies. You got to pick up the latest one that's coming out here, More Forensics and Fiction. You also got all the other ones that he's written. And, you know, as fans, once you see the in-depth detail that he writes the answers from, you're going to know that his fiction is just the same way. And it's that perfectly knowing that when you see something happen, you know that's exactly the way it's going to happen, and it's not some dramatization. We are going to take here a short break, and I'm going to play a clip here, an audio clip from Ian Walkley. It's called No Remorse. And then we're going to be on with our last guest here of the show, Eric Davis. And I hope I said it right, because it's spelled E-R-I-C, and I'm guessing it's Eric, just spelled different. And we'll be back on with him then. So until that, here you go. No Remorse from Ian Walkley.
No Remorse by Ian Walkley. Read by Paul Christie. Chapter 1. Lee McLeod ached to kill the five men in the valley below, but he couldn't. Not yet. He ignored the sharp piece of rubble under his ribs and eased the sniper rifle into the familiar position, butt firmly against his shoulder, hand cupping the grip, finger resting on the trigger guard. Like spooning with a woman, Mac reflected, though he hadn't done that in a while. He watched the Ford Explorer with Bob at the wheel racing towards the meeting point, up through the barren hills surrounding the El Carrizo Dam. He switched his view back to the five men standing around a van and a land cruiser. Checking the laser rangefinder, he adjusted the Hensoldt scope. 600 yards, as close as he and his men would dare go. They couldn't risk stirring the loose rubble to get closer. As it was, they'd only just made it into position before the Mexicans showed. He wouldn't admit it in a psych evaluation, but he enjoyed the feeling of having an enemy in the crosshairs. For a few seconds, he had godlike control. All he had to do was squeeze. But right now, they needed confirmation that Sophia and Danny were in the van before he could give the order. The exchange was taking place a few miles outside Tijuana. Desert country, scarred with boulders and littered with caves and patchy grass that reminded him of an area northeast of Kandahar, where 4 years ago his unit had freed a 6-person UNAMA team held by Taliban insurgents, but not before they had raped the two women and castrated the team leader. A gust of wind blew grit in his weathered face. Swallowing several times to suppress the urge to cough, Mac put a small pebble in his mouth, sucking on it to relieve the irritation. He could hear the click of the digital SLR behind him as Termite took photos of the kidnappers and their vehicles through the zoom lens in case they needed evidence later. He pressed his radio's talk button. Sierra 1, this is Sierra 6. Notify when you are in position. Over. He shifted his aim to the skinny one with the bow legs, who he assumed was the leader by the way he was ordering the others about. All of them wore gray uniforms with Atlantic blue caps and a Mexican flag patch on their left shoulder. The uniform of the Federales, the Mexican National Police. From the nonchalant way they were standing around, he decided they probably were real cops. If anything, this made him angrier. They were kidnappers, taking advantage of their position to earn a corrupt living. Way he figured it, killing these creeps would do both countries a favor. All the same, if they had to let the bastards go or forfeit the ransom money, he wouldn't care, so long as they got Sophia and Danny back safely. The three volunteers he'd recruited from his Delta unit knew that freeing the girls was their one and only priority.
We're good to go, Sierra 6. Over.
Scotty's voice was as mellow as a tenor's. After 6 months away from combat operations, Scotty was hungry for action and had been the first to volunteer for the unauthorized mission. Mac shifted the crosshairs of his scope to the thick-set Federale with a pockmarked face and dull eyes. This guy reeked of thug. He was spinning a long-bladed knife as though it was a juggler's club. had a tattoo of a skull on his neck, and when he laughed, his lips pulled to one side in a sneer, as though he'd been cut and sewn back together by a surgeon with Parkinson's disease. All of these guys would kill without hesitation, Mac was sure of it. Scotty and Freckle were tucked away somewhere in the shadows on the next hill. Two firing positions gave them better observation capability and a broader perimeter of fire. After the call from Bob telling him the 16-year-old best friends, Sophia and Danny, had been snatched off the street in Tijuana, he'd had just enough time to grab three volunteers, hunt down some kit from the Delta store, and hitch four seats on the shuttle from Fort Bragg to San Diego. With luck, they'd be back on base before anybody noticed. But if the shit hit the fan, they were on their own. Sierra 1, I'll take the guy with a knife and the leader with a pistol. Scotty, you take the two of the AK-47s. Freckle, you stop the van going anywhere.
Affirmative,
Scotty said. Bob's dusky silver Explorer bounced along the rutted gravel track past the ruins of an adobe hut and pulled up near the kidnapper's Land Cruiser. It was close enough now that he could hear the two fathers in the Explorer talking through the transmitter disguised in Bob's belt. The kidnapper's leader flicked his cigarette onto the barren ground and hacked up a gob of spit as the two men got out of the Explorer. None of the kidnappers made any attempt to adopt a defensive position. That was when Mac realized something wasn't right.
Welcome back, everybody. Again, that was an audio clip from the book called No Remorse by Ian Walkley, and you can go find it out on Amazon or wherever you want to go look and find out a book like that. If you want your audio clip played, simply email editor@suspensemagazine.com. Give us your audio clip of about, you know, three, four minutes, put an MP3 format, send it on your way, and we'd be more than happy to get it on the air sometime in a future show. Right now, we want to bring on our next guest, debut author Ark Davis, who just wrote his first book, and it's called A Good and Useful Hurt. And we want to welcome Ark to the show. Ark, how you doing? Thanks so much for joining us.
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Now, just to give people a little bit of background, Ark is, for the last 15 years, a tattoo and piercing. That's what you've been doing outside of Grand Rapids, Michigan. And then all of a sudden, something happened. And Ark decided, damn it, I want to write a book. And the book came out, A Good and Useful Hurt. So can you tell everybody a little bit about the book and, you know, what maybe got into your head to decide, I need to write something?
Well, I first decided I was going to start writing in 2006. And I wrote a book that went unpublished, and then another one that went unpublished, and then another one, and another one, and another one. And A Good and Useful Hurt was actually my sixth manuscript. And it was actually, not to contradict you, but actually the second one that was picked up for a professional publication. The first one was a book that came out last year called Nickel Plated.
Mm-hmm. And so, a little behind the scenes of A Good and Useful Hurt, you know, tell me a little bit about the book, you know, what it is, you know, characters involved and things like that. Since your new debut, people really don't have anything to kind of go off of. To kind of understand about, you know, who you are as an author.
It's a kind of a depressing romantic horror novel that uses a modern-day tattoo shop as sort of the backdrop for about 70% of the scenes. It's about this guy, Mike, and this woman he meets, Deb, and the kind of terrible trials and tribulations they go through with one another.
And so when you were sitting here writing, did you figure out, hey, this is a story that I want to get out, or was it more along the lines of, you know, I have some interesting character ideas in my head that I want to put into a story?
Well, it started off in 2008 on Halloween. I was bored at work at the tattoo shop, and I decided I was going to write a short story having to do with my other job. And I'd never written really anything about tattooing or piercing before, so all that stuff came really easily. So I wrote this short story in a day, kind of passed around to friends at work, let them check it out. And the idea just never really went away. And I'd write a longer piece about it and put it away and write a longer piece and put it away. And then finally just decided that I was going to really do it and hammer it out. And it came out the way that it did. I'm extremely happy with how it is. couldn't say much more positive about the publication process. My editors had some wonderful ideas, even without the tattooing or piercing experience that I have, that made it into a much more cohesive, filled-out read.
Now, the one thing that, you know, because we always get a lot of emails from authors that want to get involved with it, and I tell them, you know, it's nothing that's easy, and it's something that you have to persevere through, you know, through. Like, you started in 2006 writing, and now all of a sudden, it's, you know, your book, A Good and Useful Hurt, came out February 21st, 6 years. How much time during that time were you sitting there thinking, you know, God, I'm just going to write short stories for myself. I'm not going to worry about this whole publishing thing. Did those thoughts go through your head a lot?
Constantly. My wife got a very early on got a very good attitude about the massive number of rejection letters that we were getting in the mail. And so she'd check the mail and hand me a pile of envelopes and say, here's your rejections for the day. And, of course, they all were rejections for the day, and there were tons of rejections in the email box, just a constant stream of no, 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 no.
But then you happened on, and a lot of people might not know that 47 North is the newest imprint from Amazon, and that is Amazon.com, you know, 47 North. Now, how were you able to get involved, you know, with them, seeing as how they were so new? Did you just do a lot of research to kind of figure out that you're going to send it there? Did you have an agent? You know, how did that process work for you to get your book, A Good and Useful Hurt, published by 47 North?
It's actually a really funny story. I am still agent-free and was at the time that I got my deal with 47 North and with Amazon Publishing, but I hooked up with them initially by entering the Amazon Breakthrough Novel Award contest. Mm. And the book that I'd submitted, a novel called Nickel Plated, ended up not making it through the, I think it was the second or third round, due to me putting my name in the wrong place, basically being stupid. I got lucky, and for whatever reason, the manuscript ended up on my editor's desk. So I was checking my email in June of 2010, and I saw an email from this man named Terry that I had never sent anything to. So I immediately assumed that it was just one of those author scammy type things you hear about where, you know, you will publish your book, all it'll cost, you know, is $10,000 in publicity stuff or whatever.
Right.
But that
wasn't
the case at all. It was actually a legitimate offer to want to work with me and publish my work, and that was what happened with Nickel Plated. And then after I'd submitted A Good and Useful Hurt to Terry, and he loved it, thank goodness, he mentioned that Amazon was starting a horror imprint and that he thought it would fit really well there, which was hilarious to me at the time because I had no idea that I'd written a horror novel. But apparently it was horrific enough to be considered for that. So, yeah, it was super, super cool. They're great people.
Yeah, welcome to the publishing business on that one where it's like, oh, I wrote a horror novel. It's like, well, that's where we're going to put it because that's where we think it's going to sell.
Yeah.
And that's kind of basically what they're saying is we think it's going to sell in this category more than it would in something else. And I guess that's just them knowing their readers, which is important. You know, that's definitely important. So
yeah.
And I want to remind you know, so we're speaking here with Ark Davis, author of A Good and Useful Hurt. Book came out February 21st, 2012. You can get it wherever books are sold, Amazon, of course, and whatnot. But then, you know, I want to continue a little bit along the lines here of, you know, of your journey, because you say you don't have an agent, but you do, you know, you went out and you got a publicist, and you went out and you got a little bit of publicity. What exactly, you know, prompted you to say, hey, you know what, this is something that I think I need to do? Because authors today at age, especially, you know, when you're young and you're new, you have to get your name out there. And it is not an easy thing to do at all.
No, it's not an easy thing to do in the least. But as far as Sarah and Little Bird Publicity goes, another person who I couldn't possibly say enough good things about, I had nothing to do with her involvement in either of my books. My publisher happened to hire her for me. So not only did they handle that part of it, but they happened to hire a wonderful person for me to work with. She's just completely awesome.
And, you know, that's kind of a lucky thing is that you were able to get somebody because a lot of authors are kind of left on their own. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it's a wonderful idea, and I don't know if you thought about doing it, and I don't know if you would have now, but let's just say that you couldn't find a publisher for your book. Would you have gone ahead and just done it on your own and put it out there because you can in ebook form, But then what you have to realize is that now you're totally on your own to be able to publicize it, to market it, to do it. And it's almost spending triple the amount of time than it did actually writing the book.
Yeah, I self-published back in 2008, and I was happy with the way the book came out. I was happy that I was able to share it with family and friends and stuff, but the editing wasn't on par with anything even close to what my professional stuff has had done to it. And I don't know that I wanted to do that again. I think I might have had I gotten desperate enough, but I was almost just happy enough writing for myself, writing for the first readers that are so kind to read my work and tell me all the awful things that I've done and that I should fix immediately. And that was almost satisfying enough. I think I was happier attempting over and over again to go through Writer's Market and research all these agents and all these editors and then send off my new manuscript to them and then just repeat it kind of ad nauseum rather than dedicating, like you mentioned, all the extreme amounts of time it takes to market a self-published novel. I think I preferred to just continue writing new ones and hope that eventually something thrown to the wall would stick there.
Right, and I think that that's a lot of people right now are starting to try to understand which path that they, you know, that they want to take because of the opportunities that they have on one side and the opportunities they have on the other, you know, which side they want to take, and that's the side that you decided to go and take. And the one thing also is when you're marketing, you're going out there, you're going to get emails from fans and they're going to ask questions of this and that. How has that process been for you? Because when you wrote, you know, you wrote Nickel Plate in 2010, now you're getting this one, which is, you know, I guess it's on a much bigger scale. How has that been affecting you to maybe receive more emails from fans or, you know, people that you never heard from all of a sudden either finding you on Facebook or, you know, this and that and talking to you, and you're like, wow, I have no idea about any of that?
Everybody I've talked to has been really, really cool. I think the people that are more apt to write a bad review about the book on Goodreads or on Amazon are going to be a lot less interested in talking to somebody. I mean, who wants to talk to the author they weren't impressed by in the least, right? I mean, but everybody who has gotten a hold of me has been super cool. All the stuff that I've had to do for, you know, question and answer things for blogs or any other spots that I've had to do, everything's just been really fun. I really, really enjoy the process, as weird as it probably sounds, at least at this stage of the game.
Yeah, no, I think a lot of authors do because it is something that is just new and it's fun because you're out there in the public, and it's also scary too because for the first time you actually have to almost, you know, be judged on something that, you know, that is almost considered fun for you. And that's difficult for a lot of people to kind of understand. And I don't know if you kind of felt the same way when you decided, you know, your first marketing opportunity to go out and speak with people and, you know, have them understand your work and things like that. It had to be just nerve-wracking.
Yeah, it's a little scary. I think having such a weird job as far as working in the piercing and tattoo industry has helped a little bit with it because I already kind of do stuff every day where I basically can't ever make a mistake. So when you're under that kind of pressure on a daily or even hourly basis, it makes something like fielding a couple emailed questions or doing something like this seem a lot easier.
That is true. I mean, you're far from a weatherman who can screw up the weather and still have his job, but I guess if you kind of put, you know, misspell somebody's name that they want on their, you know, want on their arm or their leg, it's kind of a bad thing, isn't it?
Well, that would be nightmarish. I've had a long-running, like, wakeful dream of imagining myself driving to the hospital holding a towel over somebody's head and just blood going everywhere. And nothing like that has ever happened, but it's, like, it's a fear there. It could happen.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I have a tattoo, and I had a great experience. And that's definitely, you know, one thing that I would love to get again because once you get one, I know that they're very addictive. And so I would like to get one on my other arm. And I've always had wonderful experiences, you know, in there. And I think that it's great because I, you know, we did our 2,500 books last year, and I can't think of one that's actually set like where you've set it in the tattoo world, and you've able to, you know, take your experience, put it into your work, A Good and Useful Hurt, and really lay credence to, you know, giving it that realism thing that when readers read it, they're going to have an understanding of maybe what it's actually like in there, instead of the whole stigmata of, you know, all tattoos are bad and dirty and blah, 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 blah. You know, they can all go to hell. They gives it, you know, you giving them that, you know, that real sense in a fictional setting. You know, do you kind of feel that same way?
Yeah, a big part of the intent of writing it was to share that world with people that might never have any interest in seeing that world in real life. And then another part of it, and I always feel terrible when I say this, but another part of it was I think so many authors get that world wrong, and they can't help but have, you know, a character with no other tattoos, but their whole back is covered, and those people don't exist. Like, that's not a normal thing for someone just to have one enormous tattoo, or for to be able to walk into a tattoo shop in the modern era and have somebody smoking a cigarette in the store with a, you know, gun sitting on their workstation. You know, it's a job just like anything else, and it has the same requirements that you'd expect of anywhere that's going to work in public with any, you know, modicum of cleanliness.
Yeah, and do you get that sense, you know, when your fans email you and they talk to you, do they tell you and say, you know, hey, you know, thanks so much for, you know, maybe opening my eyes, or is this really true, or things like that? I mean, do you get those kinds of questions outside of the whole, you know, why the hell did you kill this person off, or is this person come back in your next book, or, you know, those types of questions?
Yeah, I actually haven't gotten any of those kinds of questions about the, did this person die or somebody coming back. I have gotten a great deal of comments from people saying, I'm so glad that you wrote about the tattooing and about piercing, either A, because they had no experience with it and were excited to learn something about it, or B, because they had an experience with it and just loved seeing it in a fictional setting when they already were familiar with it in a real-world setting.
Yeah, and that's also got to make you feel good to know, you know, not only feel good, but it gives you that sense of comfortability when you're sitting down, you're writing, and, you know, you're writing about something that you know, which I always tell people first off is write about what you know, because it makes it easy. Because actually the first book is the easiest book to write just because you have your whole life to start writing it. But then once you get published, your publisher's like, I need one in 12 months. You're like, oh, my God, it took me 5 years to write the first one. How am I going to write one in 12 months or 8 months? You know, how am I going to sit down and do that? So that's where you get your sense of being able to know how to write, and you collect those patterns and those, maybe even those superstitions. You know, did you feel that same sense writing when all of a sudden somebody said, now I need one in 8 months, now you got to start doing it? Do you feel that pressure?
I've been lucky enough never to work with a deadline other than one imposed on myself, and I think that helps a lot. I don't know how I would do with an actual deadline, but I decided to do a little writing exercise about a month ago where I ended up writing, I think it's like 55,000 words, 55,000 word novel in a little less than 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's obviously not edited or cleaned up or really even pretty at this point, but I was still able to serviceably work under this ridiculous deadline that I put myself under, where minimally I like to write when I'm in like long fiction mode about 2,000 words a day. More as like a self-imposed limit than as a minimum.
Mm-hmm.
And on the one that I was just talking about, rather than impose that limit, I just really went for it and decided to see how much I could put out in a given day, you know, writing between 5,000 and 8,000 words in a day.
And I want to remind everybody again, we're speaking here with Arik Davis, and that's A-R-I-C Davis. You can go to his website, and, you know, his website is arikdavis.com, or, you know, go to Amazon, and, you know, you can find out about the book there. You know, he's still working on, you know, getting everything. Are you on Facebook and places like that also for people to connect to you?
I avoid the Facebook like the plague.
Man, you might not be able to do that with you if you start writing, because people want to talk to you.
Well, so far no one has forced me to start Facebooking yet, so I'm avoiding it thus far. But, yeah, people can certainly get a hold of me through my website.
Yeah, and, you know, and the books are available on Amazon, of course, and, you know, wherever all the books are sold. And I guess that's, you know, that's a very exciting time also for a first author, is to be able to sit there and say that, you know, you're one of, there's not very many yet, but you're one of the first here to get involved with that 47 North project that Amazon has. You know, you're kind of like a pioneer, and that's got to kind of make you feel a little good coming right out of the gate when you're, you know, writing.
Yeah, it's totally awesome. Everything about working with Amazon so far has been incredible. Everything with the new imprint has gone, at least as far as I can tell, really, really well. certainly my book came out exactly as I wanted it to. The artwork they did for the cover is phenomenal. They took a little input that I had and then just totally blew the idea of the water, made it much cooler than I ever could have imagined. And there is something to be said for being on the ground floor with that new imprint, and even with Amazon a little bit, being such a, not a new company, but new in the publishing world, it's cool to be associated with it, especially since basically everybody else that is involved with publishing got a letter from me over the last 5 years and wanted nothing to do with it. So to have this newer company be very interested in what I was doing as a writer and want to put out my work and want to make this succeed is just that much cooler.
Right. Well, I'll tell you what, Art, we want to thank you so much for coming on. I mean, it's been fascinating. It's always great to hear, you know, the stories of the author that, you know, kind of new coming out, and especially your background from the tattoo and the piercing, because, you know, we've never had an author have that background. So it's fabulous to see, you know, what you're doing and how you put it into your book here. Again, it's called A Good and Useful Hurt by Art Davis. It was on sale February 21st. So thanks so much for joining us today, and I hope you have a fabulous one, and enjoy the rest of your ride that, you know, is coming up. You're just at the beginning, baby. You're just at the beginning.
Even being at the beginning, it's still very, very exciting. I can't wait to see what else it holds for me. Thanks a ton for having me.
Hey, thanks a lot, and you enjoy yourself.
All right, you too. Bye.
All right. Again, everybody, that was author Arc Davis, A-R-I-C's first name, Davis.com. Go to Amazon, find his book, A Good and Useful Hurt. It's out now, and, you know, it's, again, another book that we recommend that, you know, you can get on your shelf because it does have that extra added twist of, you know, tattooing and things like that that you don't actually see, and you're getting it straight from someone that, you know, kind of in that world and being able to understand. There's another thing I want to mention here, too. A friend of ours is Brett Battles, and, you know, we always love Brett's work because he's just always the solid stuff. And today, his latest book, his latest book in his Quinn novel series, The Destroyed, is out. And it just came out today, and we tweeted about it, and we want to make sure that you guys know about it. And I know that you're going to maybe hear this, maybe not on, you know, March 24th, but when you do, you'll know that you can already go out and get it. So Brett Battles is another author that, you know, I think that you should go out and recommend, and, you know, I recommend that you go out and see, you know, exactly what he's got going on. He's done a lot of stuff, but now he's doing this new Quinn series, so you want to definitely go see the book, The Destroyed. The other thing that, you know, have coming up is The Hunger Games, big-time movie coming out. It's out now, got great reviews. It's one that we're going to go out and see tomorrow. I don't know about it. I actually did not read the books. Everybody else read the books. It's very odd for us to kind of read for fun anymore. It's, you know, I mean, it's a job, and, you know, we read for a job. Now, we do have fun a lot of times reading books. Sometimes some books are good. Sometimes some books are not good, and that's just the way it goes with anything, but we always have, you know, we always get so many. Like I said, over 2,500 last year. We're going to be on pace to getting more this year. And I didn't have time to read The Hunger Games, but I'm going to go see the movie. But I did happen to be dead out of time, and Harlan Coben's book, Stay Close, is going to be coming out soon. And he has an interview in the April edition of Suspense Magazine that is coming out here soon. And the one thing that I want to mention, too, is that in the next edition of the magazine, the winners of the 2011 short story contest will be announced in the April edition of the magazine. We have the winners. I know who they are. And you're going to have to find out when you get the magazine here coming in April. And it was a very hard process, like it is every single year, to actually, you know, pick from the list of the thousands of stories that we do get. But it will be out in the April edition. You want to get 4 free issues, just email editor@suspensemagazine.com. We send them out to you. They come right to your computer. You get them emailed every month. Just take a look at them with all the great things that we have going on in there, because we spend a ton of time, you know, trying to get everything that we can for you guys. And we try to cover every single thing that we possibly can
with all the new things coming out and try to expand ourselves and even a little bit more now into the YA since it's becoming an extremely popular genre. But summer's coming up, a lot of great things happening, a lot of great things going on. We have shows packed out here now through May. We got some fascinating authors that you're going to be listening to, and you're only going to hear that right here on Suspense Radio. And we're going to go ahead right now and just let everybody know that we want to thank our guests here that were on today, D.P. Lyle, with his books, War Forensics and Fiction. You can find him at dplylemd.com. We just had Ark Davis on talking about his latest book here, A Good and Useful Hurt. And, you know, we want to thank everybody for joining us, wherever you're listening to, wherever you're at. Thank you for making Suspense Radio a little bit a part of your day. We'll be back here on April the 7th with Mary J. Clark, William Beck, and Kevin O'Brien, the 90-minute show. So until then, we'll see you all April the 7th. Goodbye, everybody, and enjoy.